The Ark of the Covenant was a large gold-plated box with winged cherubs on top and gold rings at each corner. It would slide big poles through those gold rings, and it took four or more people to lift up those poles and carry the Ark of the Covenant. The Ark was placed at the tent, in the tent of the meeting, or the tabernacle, a movable tent that traveled with the Jewish people as they wandered through the wilderness after they left Egypt. The tent was a sign of God's dwelling in the midst of God's people, God's home, perhaps. The Ark was thought to contain the tablets of the Ten Commandments. And in addition to being a storage box for the stone tablets, the Ark was a portable throne where God would be seated, the invisible God, because Mosaic law did not allow the Jewish people to create or manufacture an image of God. So the Ark was carried into battle to encourage the troops. Surely if God was here with us, seated on the throne, how could we lose? Before the time of King David, the tent and the Ark were kept at Shiloh, a place where the tribes would gather a little bit north of Jerusalem. Shiloh was a gathering place for the tribal confederacy before the time of the kings, before King David. In a battle with the Philistines, the Israelites lost the battle and they lost the Ark. It was a devastating blow to lose this uniting symbol for the tribes of Israel, the sign that God lived among them and cared for them. How could this happen? It was a big deal. This perceived weakness of the tribal confederacy during this time of the judges led to the desire for a more centralized government and the desire to have a heroic king, a savior, one who could take care of the enemy. So reluctantly, Samuel, the last judge of Israel, anointed Saul as king, and then David as Saul's successor. Well, David was able to unite the tribes of Yahweh into a single nation with a capital city, Jerusalem, a city kind of on the border between the northern and southern tribes, kind of a neutral city, and establish a kingdom there. King David built himself a house, a palace, and he rescued the Ark of the Covenant and brought it back into Jerusalem together with the Tent of Meeting. And his wife was scandalized because David danced naked in front of the Ark as it processed into the city. And in the 2 Samuel text that was read today, King David wants to build a magnificent temple to house the Ark and replace the tent, a more fitting home for God. Well, kings are able to control many things, but Israel was not ready to leave behind this legacy of wandering and tribal independence that had been their culture and custom for many centuries. Nathan the prophet, representing this conservative faction, counseled King David that he was going too fast, and that Yahweh had not dwelt in a house since the time of the Exodus, but had been moving about in a tent. It's interesting, as we were reading that text today, at first Nathan says, okay, go ahead and build this temple. And then kind of a reversal where God said, no, you have to give a different word to David. And then David was reminded of his humble beginnings, and kind of a reversal happened there. So King David's legacy was not to be temple building. Maybe writing songs was his thing. Many of the Psalms of the Old Testament were ascribed to David, the songwriter. So he had to leave the temple building to his son Solomon, who built temples all over the place, and especially the magnificent first Jewish temple. But by the time of Solomon, the idea of a Davidic reign or a dynasty that would last forever was embedded deeply into the religious life of Israel, an idea that would emerge again and again to give a future hope to the Jewish people, a messianic hope that was firmly in place when Jesus appeared as the apparent heir to the throne of David. So the angel Gabriel announces God's intent to marry. And now you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you will name him Jesus. He will be great, and he will be called the Son of the Most High, and the Lord will give to him the throne of his ancestor David. So you have centuries later, you have this dynasty continuing. So Mary is surprised and concerned, but in the end she said, "Here am I, the servant of the Lord, let it be to me with me according to your word." In our modern context, we would probably be disturbed by the idea of women becoming pregnant without their consent and being relegated to subservient roles. The two women at the beginning of Luke's gospel, Elizabeth, mother of John, and Mary of Nazareth, are powerful woman characters. Elizabeth and Mary bear sons, and they make important speeches at the beginning of Luke's gospel. Elizabeth names Mary as the mother of my Lord, perhaps the first identification of who this person Jesus was to be. Mary's Magnificat, "My soul magnifies the Lord," proclaims good news of God's presence and social justice. Even though the writer of Luke pays attention to women in Luke and Acts, these women are portrayed in the traditional role of childbearing. The primary interest seems to be their sons, John the Baptist and Jesus. We are dealing with ancient texts and ancient cultures. But we are also dealing with an understanding that these ancient texts have something to reveal to us about God. And from the Christian perspective, we understand this baby of Mary to be a unique revealing of God. Luke is telling the story of Jesus and telling the story of the community that was formed because of him. As it turns out, this son of David does not perform in the expected way. He does not become the warrior king like his ancestor, King David. He is a healer and a teacher. He does not raise an army. He calls disciples. He does not drive out the Roman occupiers. They become included in a larger reality, the reign of God. They are human as well. Jesus doesn't build a new home for God. He seems more concerned about the plight of the homeless and the marginal. He critiques the powerful and pays attention to the feeble. We are not sure where he considers home at all. He mucks around in the small towns and hill country, and when he finally ends up in Jerusalem, he is arrested, tortured, and executed without lifting a finger against enemies to save himself. What kind of person does this? And what a contrast to the dominant culture where power is amassed through military might, palaces are built to impress and to intimidate, temples are built to solidify control and power and wealth, and individuals become parts, small parts, in big systems. In the midst of empire, who pays attention to the birth of poor children to poor mothers? Builders of kingdoms, builders of temples. The pharaohs of Egypt showed God's people that path, and it led to slavery and oppression. The way of Jesus defines a new ordering of relationships and economics, an order characterized by mercy, peace, and justice, a place where love is at home. I see the arrival of Jesus and the Christian movement as a countercultural movement pointing humankind toward a more sustainable future. Jesus and the early Christian community present a trajectory paradigm for understanding true humanity and humaneness. A quote from Gordon Kaufman. The gospel writers are attempting to communicate that to their audience at the time, and they use interesting language and stories from their culture, like angels and shepherds and Gabriel and announcements of this and that, and they pull prophecies from the ancient past and weave it together to give a story that captures our attention and our imagination, that attempts to bring together the divine and the human and show us where we are located in that story. So we gather this month and during this season to celebrate the birth of Christ, an event that I think was a turning point in history that puts humanity on a different path. I think the old patterns of domination and control and imperialism and wanting to manage people as economic units continues, does it not? But we belong to a different order and are able to see through some of the facades of the culture that we live in. And we're called to a different way of being human, the way of Jesus, a way that practices peace, a way that treats people with dignity and respect, and a way that helps us walk with God, walk in the Spirit, a way that is wonderful and mysterious, the way of love. So where does love make its home? I think in this story, in the gospel story, love makes its home with humanity. That's with us, that's with you and me. And how we live out that expression of love is up to us as we make choices in our lives each day. That's what the birth of Jesus begins to tell me without hearing the rest of the story. What does it tell you?